and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at Alfred Hitchcock and his 1941 film, Suspicion. Returning on the show today to talk about Suspicion is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So yes, this is the second time I've seen this, and it's been a while since I've seen this, and there's a reason why it's been a while since I've seen this. I'm a big Hitchcock fan, and it's not that I don't like this film, it's just a perfect example of a film that has an ending that just sort of destroys almost the entire movie for me. And spoiler alert, because we're talking about the ending, obviously, I don't like the whole fact that it's all just one big misunderstanding, that if she just had a little bit more faith in her husband, he was an okay guy, and everything, all her suspicions, which are completely reasonable because he is being crazy, he's doing all these bad things, she should suspect him of murder, especially since he's hanging around with that Agatha Christie like novel writer and getting all these ideas from her. I just think, he's just going through a hard time, and he was trying to kill himself because he's just feels so put upon. Like, I don't like that ending, and I know he didn't like it either, Hitchcock.
But I think you can interpret the ending as, oh, it's just a misunderstanding, or is it? Because I think it does leave that question up in the air. When I watched it as a child, this is a sentimental favorite of mine. Whenever I would catch it on TV, I would always watch it. I just thought it was so incredibly charming. But I always thought in the end that it was just one more line. It was just one more way to get her back.
Oh, okay.
And he was just going to continue to be the same rake that he always was. That's how I understood it as a child. And then when I read about it, that it was based on a story where it's supposed to be about a woman who is implicated in her own death. She is an accessory before the fact because she knows that her husband is going to try to kill her, and she goes along with it. And in the story, she writes a letter to her mother saying, you know, I know he's going to kill me, and, I can't live without him. And, and then she gives the letter to him to mail, and he does mail it.
Oh.
And so that's how the book ends. So you know that he's going to be caught, that she, yes, she was implicated in her own death, but she did leave a clue for people to figure it out.
Yeah. And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so that's what Hitchcock liked about it. But they told him, no, we can't have Cary Grant be, really be a bad guy. Uh-huh. People just won't like that. So they made him change the ending, but he got his own in there because in the cameo, he is mailing a letter. So that's his way of getting it in there.
Yeah, as I read about that, he wanted a different ending. I believe his intended ending was the famous scene with the glowing milk or poison. She knows it's poison, but, like you said, because she's too much in love with him, so she can't bear to live without him, she'll just accept the poison and accept her own death. I think that would be a much more powerful ending than you bring up an interesting thing. Maybe he's always going to be kind of on this, and she's always going to be on the edge because she doesn't know if keeps on being a scoundrel, or he's going to keep trying to find ways to bump her off or something to get her inheritance. She never knows. That's interesting, but I just got, They're riding along. He's got a hand on her shoulder. It seems all happy. They're riding off in the sunset together. Whatever problems they have, they'll face it together and they'll be out okay,
Yeah, or.
Yeah, or.
Yeah. Or, yeah, ellipsis. And it has some great Hitchcock moments in it. When she thinks, oh my God, is he going to kill his business partner? And then it shows, what she is imagining, which is him, pushing him off the cliff and him falling. That whole falling scene is so Hitchcock. And even though it's macabre, it's funny.
Because the main character is funny because he keeps saying, oh, I put my foot in the mouth again,
yes.
Haven't I?
Isn't he a great character, Nigel Bruce Beakey?
Mm-hmm. And very a little bit similar to kind of his characteristics and his character in Rebecca. Mm-hmm. Kind of that, he's very loud mouthed, a bit obnoxious, and he just doesn't know when to shut up.
Yeah,
but you still like him anyway.
Yeah, the doofus. Yeah, he's very sweet. And I think one of the things that saves Cary Grant's character is that you realize all along that he really, really did love that guy as a friend. At first you think he's just a user. He uses everybody. And he only likes him because his friend forgives him everything. But you can see at the end he's really pretty torn up that...
It's interesting. I thought if there's a MacGuffin in this film, then who really was that person with him in Paris that... got him to do that drinking contest that got Beakey killed.
Yes. Well, it could be any Englishman who thinks it's a challenge.
Yeah, because it makes you think. Because what I did like, well, they did set it up at the beginning where I think he's drinking too much mm-hmm. or something, and so he just has trouble breathing or coughing. And he says, well, he'll either die or he'll just pass through his system.
Yeah.
And so that'll kill him one day, and it perfectly sets it up.
Right. So you kind of see it coming, but you also see that Cary Grant's completely aware of it. So when they say he was seen in the company of a Englishman who kept calling him Hall Bean or
Old Bean.
Yeah. And since they said it so many times, you think, oh my God, it's got to be him. It plays on your own suspicions.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. Yeah. And Hitchcock hated that title, by the way. He thought it sounded like a cheesy romance novel. He wanted to call it Johnny after the main character. Okay.
You know, you did talk. I want to bring up one thing. You talked about how there are a lot of great Hitchcock moments in there. I definitely agree. I think one that probably gets brought up the most when you discuss this film is the glowing milk mm-hmm. scene. He's walking through the house is all dark. He's slowly walking up the steps, and he's got this milk, and it's glowing. You know, it looks like it's glow in the dark. I forget. Like there's a way he put a light under the milk.
He put a light inside of it. Yeah, that's a really cool scene. Mm-hmm.
And just the way that the whole lights and shadows almost feels like something out of like an expressionist film or a horror film. And he does it very well. And that's probably one of the classic Hitchcock moments.
Plus, he starts off on a train. You know, he has some sort of meet cute on the train. And she's doing the glasses thing, you know, reading about childhood development or something really dry. So she's the librarian. You know, they set her up mm-hmm. as the librarian. And here comes Cary Grant, you know, being Cary Grant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's very charming and she notices him. And what I love about her character is she is this very prim spinster. And yet, once she becomes fascinated by Johnny Asgarth, she stalks him.
Yeah, it's a bit creepy in the beginning because you see she's got all of these things on him. And like, that's kind of stalkerish,
yeah,
right?
She's cut out things from the newspaper. She's calling where he's supposed to be to see if she can find him. It's great stuff for the 40s because, you know, otherwise, she would have just been this ingenue, just waiting for life to happen to her. Gives her a little bit of agency, but also, you know, it makes her relatable. Mm-hmm. Also, she keeps getting caught.
Yeah.
You know, he finds the book with the press clipping in it. So he knows that she's got a crush on him.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine this if it was a guy doing this to a woman where he's stalking her. So that would be in a horror film. She opens the door and he's got all these pictures of her and everything.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. They would have played that differently. But that makes her very relatable. And then the overheard conversation where her father's saying, well, you know, she's never going to get married. There's nothing wrong mm-hmm. with being a spinster and taking care of your parents. And then she immediately turns around and runs toward Cary Grant and gives him a big smooch. Mm-hmm. Like, wait a minute. I still have a card to play here.
And, you know, if we talk about Joan Fontaine, this was 1 year after her other role, another Hitchcock film, Rebecca. And I feel that there's a lot of similarities you can draw, especially in the beginning, because in the beginning of both films, you know, they're courted by this, you know, wealthy guy, or this movie supposedly wealthy guy. And, you know, they're at the beginning, they're very kind of socially awkward. They don't know what to say. They're very shy in a bit. And usually throughout the movie, they sort of gain more confidence and sort of find themselves.
Right, yes. Mm-hmm. And she plays just the sweet, innocent, who was taken in by the smooth-talking older man. Mm-hmm. I do love the scene where Cary Grant comes by with the two gossips and says, well, we came to, you know, walk you to church. Mm-hmm. And so they all start walking to church, and then he, you know, wants to go for a walk. And they leave the two women going into church where they don't even want to go. Yeah. See, scenes like that, that's so Hitchcock. It's amusing. It's not, you know, thigh-slappingly funny. But it gives some moments of comic relief to what is otherwise a pretty sinister idea that somebody is after you for your money and going to kill you to get it.
And even more Hitchcock is the very next scene after that. They're walking, and then you see her, and she's like fighting against mm-hmm. him. You think, is he trying to kill her or something? And it just kind of builds up what you're going to see at the end.
Yeah, and then he does the funny thing with her hair. There's just so many nice moments. And then, of course, the absolutely non-convincing car chase scenes, which you can see are totally done with rear production. But that's, you know, part of the fun of watching movies from the 40s is it looks fake and you kind of like that it's fake.
Yeah, like you, once again, like I talked about this, one of my favorite laugh out loud scenes movie was an airplane when they're driving on, it's obviously rear projection, and then the screen changes, so like they're in a cowboys are chasing them, and then just all this crazy stuff keeps going behind them.
Now, in the original story, Johnny Asgarth is, his adultery is more obvious. The the maid that he that you see, he definitely has an affair with her in the book. It's not implied. It's a definite thing. And the maid's played by Heather Angel, who was in Lifeboat. She was the woman with the baby.
Oh, okay. The one that dies very early on.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, I hit Lifeboat, unrelated, has one of my favorite Hitchcock cameos with the Reducto.
Yes, yeah. That is one of the best ones ever. We'll have to do Lifeboat. Mm-hmm. And of course, it has Leo G. Carroll as Captain Milbeck. He always, you know, shows up as sort of the, you know, tough talking.
Yeah, talk some sense into you.
Yes, talk some sense into you. And I love what you said about the writer who's supposed to be like Agatha Christie.
Yeah, that was, I always wondered about that because I was thinking she's Agatha Christie is very famous for doing a lot of murder mystery novels. She basically created the genre. And I was just thinking about this movie and I'm like, wait a minute. Her and Hitchcock are very similar. And I looked, like, they never did a movie together. And I just think, like, you would just automatically assume, even if it's just like some movie you never heard of, they would do at least one.
Like Murder on the Orient Express. That would have been a cool Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, or even like 10 Little Indians, which yes. They did do, but they didn't do that. Like one of those movies, like you just think, how did these two not do a movie together?
That's a really good question. And I don't know if this was his way of alluding to that, but that character, she cracks me up because she's so full of herself. Mm-hmm. You know, Lena, the Joan Fontaine character, is talking to her about how she was reading one of her novels and she, you know, couldn't put it down. And they get off topic, but the writer gets right back to it. So you were saying you were totally fascinated?
I do love the fact that she gets all the ideas from her brother who works in the morgue.
Yes.
And like on the dinner table, they're just calmly talking about all the murders that he's seen over the years. And it's so funny.
And isn't he a great Hitchcock character? Mm-hmm. The sort of the person with the weird backstory, you know, who provides some comic relief and also intellectual discourse.
It reminds me a little bit of the character of Hume Cronin in Shadow of a Doubt. He would always go over to the angel from It's a Wonderful Life, who plays the father of Teresa Wright. And every time they go over, they talk about, I would kill, this is how I would kill you.
Right. Mushrooms? Would you have eaten that? Yeah, I would have eaten it. Well, then you'd be dead. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, mm-hmm.
Do you notice anything in that drink I put in you today? You know? It was always fun. Let's see. Yeah, you talk about Cary Grant, just... like you said, they are afraid to make him the bad guy. And I just, yeah, this was definitely at the time where he was doing a lot of Howard Hawks screwball comedies and always being the funny leading man who could always make the jokes and always get the girl at the end. I guess like you're built up like that, you just can't go against it. But he was doing it pretty well. And I just thought, you got to play it out more and then just try to give it a nicely wrapped up ending.
Although if anybody was going to pull the wool over your eyes with their charm and succeed... Mm-hmm. I mean, who doesn't want to believe Cary Grant? And the writing is terrific. Two of the screenwriters on this are Alma Reville, Hitchcock's wife, and Joan Harrison, who was involved in his TV show for many, many years. And the script is terrific because some of the things that he says to her are just, they just land so well when she says, you know, do you always, you know, are you always dishonest with women? And he says, no, I just think that this is what would work with you. Mm-hmm. I mean, really smart dialogue.
Yeah,
you can see why she would fall in love with him, even if she, in the back of her mind, knows better.
Yeah, because he's being very direct with her and honest, well, at least at that point.
But right.
Even like, you know, I've lost, you know, 73, I think. I just count him over every time I go to bed like sheep hopping over a fence, you know?
It does a good job of sort of making you think, oh, he's a jerk. And then, oh, no, he's not. No, he's a great guy. Oh, he didn't really mean to sell those chairs. And look, he got them back. And mm-hmm. all this other stuff, too. You know, he's really a good guy.
You keep wanting to make excuses for him like she is.
Yeah. And I love other things about it, just the way it portrays that sort of upper class English life, because I think this was the last movie he made in Britain until he came back into Frenzy. But he has, you know, like they play Scrabble. Now, I don't know about you, but, you know, I don't play Scrabble in a green velvet dress. You know, you dress up and you put your jewelry on to play Scrabble. But it makes for a great costume when she does that, you know, very dramatic feint.
Yeah, when she says murderer, and then that's when she gets the
vision of Beaky going over the cliff.
And let's see what else.
Now, the dogs, by the way, the dogs you see in that movie when Johnny Aysgarth comes home with the chairs and with all the stuff, those are actually Hitchcock's real dogs.
Oh, really?
When in doubt, cast the family.
No, he did that with his daughter.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, he did. Three times.
It was interesting. You talked about how this film was made in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
But I was watching the thing, and the first thing I thought of was RKO Pictures. So was this one of the other films that, you know, was part of his dreaded relationship with David O. Selznick?
I think this was right before, but I know that this actually did really well for RKO. So whatever they had to do to make it, I think everybody made money.
Okay. But, like, no, there wasn't, like, I know, like, a lot of time during this decade, like, you always talk about how much him and Selznick went at it. There was no stories for this one?
No, not for this one. But this is coming right off of Rebecca, where I think they had pretty much come to the end of being able to work with each other.
Okay. And one thing, you talk about comic relief in the film. One scene in the film, which I didn't know if it was comic relief because I kept thinking it was going some other way the first time I watched it, was one of the detectives keeps looking at the painting.
Yes.
And I kept thinking, like he's going to say, that painting was stolen. It was just stolen or something. You know, we feel like he stole it. But I guess, is it comic relief? Because I wasn't laughing because I thought it was going to be a part of the story. He kept looking at it.
Hitchcock and his wife apparently were great art collectors. And I think that scene, because he's done it before, or he did it afterwards. He's done it more than once. He does it in Rear Window, too, where the policeman is looking at it, you know, looks sort of confused, like he can't quite figure out what modern art's all about. And there's even a little bit of that in Rope, where, you know, the young woman says, you know, this is his early primitive, you know, looking at it. But in this instance, I think this is a way to make the police look like bumbling idiots, kind because goofy, that's one of his things.
Inspector Clouseau or somebody.
Or just sort of not very bright. So they wouldn't understand art. I think that's the joke.
And one thing I thought was really interesting in this film was the use of music. Now, it's the main theme you hear for most of this film is Wiener Blut. It's by Strauss, and I think it's translated to Vienna Blood. And it's sort of at the beginning, it's played when she's at the ball and she's dancing, and it's very happy, and they're dancing. But like as the theme keeps playing, it gets a little bit more variation. So it's a bit more sinister. It's when she starts suspecting that her husband may be trying to kill her.
Yeah, and I think it's Franz Waxman. And it's, there's a waltz that plays during the happy times, and then there's a version of it that's more of a doom-laden version of it. Yeah, and it plays when they come back from their honeymoon, and he says, you know, do you remember all these places that we went? And you hear that music come up.
Mm-hmm. It's even playing on the record player when they're using it. And so this is for 1941, and Rebecca was in 1940. So did this film, do you really think it, these are the two films that really established Hitchcock in the U.S.?
I think so, and also Joan Fontaine. I just recently watched another Joan Fontaine movie, which is a little hard to get, with Jimmy Stewart, called You Gotta Stay Happy. And it is so unbelievably of its time. But, you know, some of the jokes are still funny. You know, they're making comments about, you know, looking out for the Russians and, you know, they're watching us and listening to us. And you hear it now, it seems like it's, you know, relevant to
today.
Was
this post-World War II?
Yeah.
Okay.
And very, very, well, I'll bring it in. You can watch it.
Yeah, who directed it?
No, I can't remember who directed it. It was, I had to buy it. You can't get it from Netflix. You can't stream it anywhere.
This is following a train of thought, but you're talking about Joan Fontaine. She just recently passed away, and her sister is Olivia de Havilland, who is unbelievably still alive, over 100. Now,
they had a feud.
They did, and I was reading that because recently on FX there was that series called Feud with Betty and Joan about the making of Who Killed Baby Jane.
Jane.
And I know that they're trying to do another one about her and Olivia de Havilland, and Olivia wrote back and said they never really had a feud. So I was wondering if you could pick up anything on that.
You know, from what I understand, they were each jealous of each other's careers. You know, Olivia de Havilland had Gone with the Wind. And I think Rebecca was supposed to be, you know, the answer to Gone with the Wind. So it's supposed to put Joan Fontaine on equal footing. And I don't know if it was for real or not, but they sure talked about it like it was a ongoing feud where the two of them wouldn't even speak to each other. I can only think of Gone with the Wind when I think of Olivia de Havilland. And I've seen these three Joan Fontaine movies, and she always plays the same character, sort of the sweet, innocent, you know, wide-eyed innocent who's ripe for somebody to, you know, deceive.
Yeah, and it was Olivia de Havilland, the only film of hers I've seen, because I still haven't seen Gone with the Wind, but I've seen Adventures of Robin Hood.
Okay.
And I've John Fontaine, I've seen the two Hitchcocks, this movie and Rebecca. So,
Hitchcock made her dye her hair more blonde. He wanted her to be...
No, that's Hitchcock. He's always got to have his blonde.
Got to have that blonde. Yeah. It's also got the Brandy motif in it. A lot of Hitchcock's movies have some sort of Brandy or reference to Brandy in them.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so the fact that... I can't believe that hasn't come up before and when we've been talking about it. But, so in this one, of course, the Brandy is what does in Beaky. Also, the idea of the likable criminal. Even if Cary Grant did do it, you still like him.
Yeah, and I think you'd even sort of use that at him being likable but still a criminal, like in To Catch a Thief, because in that movie he was like a retired jewel thief or something, right?
Yeah, and then again, a character who's, you know, somebody who maybe isn't what they seem to be. Same thing in North by Northwest.
Mm-hmm. And even, you know, this movie also follows the Hitchcock thing of somebody being accused of something they didn't really do. I mean, nobody's accusing him quite yet, but she keeps thinking throughout the movie.
Another great scene is when he is talking to the portrait of her father and says, you know, well, you hear that? And he hits it and it almost looks like the painting is reacting
falling.
To him.
Let's see what else. So we've been talking about a lot about how, you know, I didn't like the ending. One thing I forgot to bring up I want to talk about is, do you think also just like in any way the Hays Code had anything to do with it? Because... You know, the Hays Code says a murderer has to, you know, be suffered for, you know, their crimes. They have to either get killed or arrested or something.
A crime can't pay.
Yeah, and connecting to Cary Grant, nobody wants to see him. They also think like, well, that means we got to kill Cary Grant. And, you know, who wants to see a movie where Cary Grant dies? You think that had to play in it too?
Or who wants to see a movie where Cary Grant is arrested? But, you know, I think Hitchcock got back at them by, you know, doing the cameo by mailing the letter. And also that... ambiguous character in the dinner scene, Phyllis, who looks like she may be Agatha Christie character's gay lover.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, she's dressed very mannishly, but no mention is made of what that means or whatever. But I think that's Hitchcock just throwing something in there that everyone's going to notice, but no one's going to mention.
I was kind of thinking, I wonder if they're implying a relationship between those, because that other guy was her brother, so nothing right. going on there. But all right, and so... keeping on going on with this ending, I mean, like I said, I'm not a big fan of it. I think it really brings down the entire film. Other movies that you think overall are good, but just have an ending that you think really bring it down. The two I put is one is I Am Legend, starring Will Smith. It's one of the most notorious bad endings. The original ending, which you can see, kind of brought this thing where, you know, Will Smith realizes that, you know, yes, they're, you know, these are like zombie-like creatures, but they're still retain some sort of humanity. And, you know, he thinks like, well, I've been killing a lot of them doing all these testing. So it makes him, you know, really think about what he's been doing to them. And in the theatrical one, he just sacrifices himself to save the kid and, you know, the kid and his mom. And that one, and then another one, I mean, I love the Coen brothers, but I still don't like No Country for Old Men just because of that ending. Cause you're just like, that's it. You know, so like, what other movies would you say?
I would say there is this wonderful Dutch movie called Spoorloos, which is The Vanishing. And it's about a serial killer who lures women and buries them alive. Hmm. And so this happens to one character, and then her boyfriend spends most of the movie trying to find out what happened to her. And he finally meets up with this guy who says, well, I'll show you what happened, but you have to drink this and then you'll know everything. Otherwise, you'll die not knowing. So he drinks it. He wakes up. He's buried underground. And that's how they leave him. They leave the movie there. They leave him underground.
You don't find out what happened?
No, it's awesome. So they decide, well, you know what? That was a pretty good movie. It did well in the Netherlands. So let's remake it. And they even got the same guy who wrote the first one to, you know, redo it for an American audience. It's called The Vanishing. It has Kiefer Sutherland in it. And a whole bunch of name brand people.
Okay. When did this come out?
Oh, I don't have the exact date. Okay. But the point is, when they got to the end, they couldn't leave him in the ground. They had to dig him up, which ruined the movie because what made it so shocking was that they left him under. So when I've shown that in class, I've asked the students to think about how famous do you have to be before they have to dig you up? You know, if you're going to make the movie and you're going to star Tom Cruise, you know, can you leave Tom Cruise, you know, or do you have to dig him up? Because if it's enough of an unknown, the students would think, yeah, you could probably get away with it. But if it's a star, you can't. And that kind of brings me back to the Cary Grant thing. There's certain things that are go with expectations of what people want from their movie stars. And sometimes it kills the movie if you go with that.
Definitely.
But I can give you both of those movies. You can compare them both. Okay. And see what they changed. I don't know why they remade it at all. The first one was just so different and terrifying and Hitchcockian, really. And the remake is just awful.
Yeah. Oh, I'm trying to think of another original foreign film remade in America that's just, the remake is just terrible.
That happens a lot. And we discussed...
Brothers is a good
Brothers,
one.
Yes, yeah. That's a good one. And Psycho, we talked about how that speech that's made at the end about, you know, mental health is completely, it's a mood killer.
Yeah, it's just basically like, in case you didn't catch it, here's what really happened.
I wonder if we have a jaded outlook because we've heard about all of these things. And maybe it was so new in the 60s that it had to be stated. But, you know, when you watch the movie again later, it feels very pedantic. Like, you really need to spell it out.
Might not work for a modern audience, but 1960s audience who probably, because of the Hays Code and stuff, couldn't get all out of that stuff. Maybe, you know, they're like, well, we do need that.
Yeah. Now, actually, speaking of the Hays Code and Psycho, I just read recently that when they were filming that, they decided not only were they going to show a toilet for the very first time, it had to be part of the plot. Mm-hmm. So they actually wrote in the fact that she writes something on some paper, tears it up, and flushes it.
I know.
Just to get it in there.
I remember I forget who the screenwriters were, but they said they were so excited that they're going to have a scene with a toilet in it.
I guess you have to take your thrills where you can get them, right?
Yeah. Okay, so getting close to the end of my questions, is there anything I haven't brought up that you want to bring up now?
One thing I like to do when I've taught Hitchcock in the classroom, is I'll show an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents called The Legacy. And it's a story of a woman who is, you know, she's very rich. She's married to a man who pays no attention to her. And they're on vacation and she meets this exotic playboy. And he seemingly falls in love with her. And you find out at the end that he's hoping, you know... Mm-hmm. to get her money. But she thinks he has killed himself because she refused him.
Oh.
So the question at the end is, you know, would you want to know? Or would you want to go through your whole life not knowing? And the character is very similar to Lena in Suspicion in that she's sweet, she's trusting, and she wants to believe the best in everybody. So, and then in the end, she sort of blossoms into this lovely woman with some confidence. Mm-hmm. So there's some similarities between the two. I just think that's one of Hitchcock's favorite things. You know, the librarian takes off the glasses and has the makeover and finds love. But there's always some price to be paid. And sometimes it's the not knowing. And I think since my interpretation of the end of Suspicion is, yeah, maybe he came clean, but maybe this is just one more day of him being.
Yeah, you can definitely interpret that. Maybe if that was really it, then I would change my mind. But I don't know. Just when it's the happy music. He's got his arm on her shoulder. They're riding off together. I just think it's supposedly everything's going to be fine.
Well, maybe, or not.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Alfred Hitchcock and his 1941 film Suspicion. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Tuesday at 7, Saturday at 1, or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, I always think of my murderers as my heroes.